I think the jacket's just a bit much for this morning. But it's a good place to put cell phones and other accoutrements. I need a merce. You know what a merce is? A man purse. Before I begin my remarks this morning, I just want to bring greetings from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign. I have been a proud member there since, well, I don't remember when I actually joined the book, but my husband, Tim, and I, we're 35 years now, but we started attending there in 1994, and we didn't really feel all that welcomed. And last evening, when I met with the search committee to prepare for today's workshop and to talk about some of the things that we would be doing, I heard a number of people say that they had visited other churches, not just UU churches, but others in the area, and they didn't really feel welcomed. Well, that's how Tim and I felt when we first visited the Urbana Church. And we went several Sundays because we thought maybe that was an off Sunday, or we didn't know exactly what the deal was. We saw a couple other people that we knew were gay or lesbian, but we just thought, they didn't seem welcoming to not just gays or lesbians, but to anybody. And we didn't go back. And then I happened to read in our newspaper that the district administrator for the Central Midwest District at that time, her name was Helen Bishop, was going to be in the pulpit talking about the Welcoming Congregation Program. I learned that the minister that was in place in 1994 had left and that they now had an interim minister, and that they were beginning the welcoming congregation process. And I thought, well, maybe there's hope, because I had done enough research on the UUA website to know what the welcoming congregation was, that even though the broader denomination is accepting and welcoming and has been for a very long time, longer than most other, I don't know, are we a mainstream church? Sometimes I think not. But the overall denomination has been very accepting, but that they had found in some instances some churches weren't as accepting, or maybe we were more accepting than we thought, or there were pockets within churches. So the Urbana Church had begun the welcoming congregation process, and that's kind of interesting because oftentimes people think that I started it. No, I didn't start it. I started coming because someone else had started it. And when Tim and I went back, we heard Helen Bishop talk about the welcoming congregation process. We met people that had begun the process, and we learned that they were in a particularly difficult time with a minister, and so that when we visited, the church was very inwardly focused, and they weren't real, I don't know what the deal was, but they just didn't really greet us at hospitality or whatever. But we went back and gave them a second chance. Churches go through different stages of life, not just based on the ministers that they call, but based on other things that are going on within the congregation, between people in the congregations. It's just like a family. It's a chosen family. And we went back in 96 when they called their new ministers, whether some of you have been up there or not, our new Reverend Axel and Elaine Gehrman. They were called as co-ministers in 96. And then a few years later, Elaine resigned from the ministry, went on to school to get a law degree, and Axel took over. Well, guess what? After 19 years of ministry with Axel, and the only minister that I've known in that pulpit, we just found out, well, we didn't just find out, but a few months ago, Axel announced he had taken a church in Monterey, California. Now, the Midwest to California, I don't understand, because I'm a Midwest boy, born and bred. I am stuck here. But it's an opportunity for us, too. We are beginning a two-year interim search process. Our new interim just began a few weeks ago. And so I'll be sitting where you are, I guess, at the midpoint, because I believe you're 1 year into your search process. Well, the whole topic of beyond categorical thinking is one that sometimes people wonder about, well, what's it really about? I don't think categorically. I try to think of everybody as a broad perspective kind of person. But we all have our stories. And what I'm going to share with you this morning is more or less my story of growing up and the impact that the categorical thinking of society had on me. And sometimes people are a little bit surprised to find out that even though I identify as a gay, quote, bisexual man, and I often don't say bisexual in Urbana because having been in a relationship with another guy for 35 years, people just don't understand that. Bisexual is a little harder for people to understand, but if you come to the workshop this afternoon, we'll help demystify some of that too. But at the beginning of the service, Mary read a discussion about what categorical thinking and the workshop is all about, that if you participate this afternoon. But if we're to move beyond something, don't we need to know more about what it is and what the result might be in the lives of real people? And my remarks this morning are actually from an autobiography that I wrote and presented at one of our Urbana UU church services about spiritual journeys. So my spiritual journey was very much a result of the categorical thinking ingrained in by our society. So my spiritual journey began with a smack on the butt when I dared question the existence of God. I was 5 or 6. I had just been tucked into bed by my dad after having said the obligatory, "Now I lay me down to sleep" prayer. I said, "How do we know there even is a God?" Smack. And that's my only recollection of ever having been spanked by my dad. Now, my family attended church religiously every other Sunday. I don't know that they consciously thought of this, but they didn't want people thinking of us as too pious, but they also didn't want the townspeople thinking us too heathen. Ours was a chameleon existence, trying to please all segments of our little farm community. Belief in all the Bible stories taught in Sunday school, and then later taught all the creeds in what the Methodists call confirmation class, I still had a lot of difficulty in really believing much of what was taught. But I always remembered the lesson of the butt smack. Be careful where you question the so-called truths. Friends have often heard me refer to my childhood as being middle-of-the-road Methodist. My parents were actually pretty liberal, but as I went through the painful awareness of my growing attraction toward men, which actually started quite early, I still didn't feel I could talk to parents or anyone else about why I reacted so strongly to a naked male chest throwing hay bales. At that point, the buxom calendar pinups that I saw in most tractor repair places or the taverns that I frequented with my dad and his cronies, they did little to spark my interest. But I knew what I did like to look at. I learned that one didn't talk about those things, and one also didn't talk about religion. But deep inside, I felt a spiritual longing or calling. I think it might have been in connection with a deep pain that I felt over my secret. As I went through junior high and puberty, the homosexual urges only got stronger, as did the desire for some sort of spiritual or religious experience, something that was more satisfying than middle-of-the-road Methodism. I dealt with my childhood stress with overeating, and I became the fat and happy, on the outside, class clown. I learned in high school that alcohol was an even better stress reliever and provided a lot more fodder for being that class clown. Most weekend nights found me out with the guys from the football team. I had to do something to fit in with that crowd, driving around the country roads, drinking, going to Woodsy's or whatever else it was, and just thinking this is what everybody does. At one point, the fears on my homosexual desires became so much that I discussed it with an adult, and I didn't feel I could ever discuss it with my family, but I'd been working in a local insurance company, and one of my dad's longtime friends from childhood had found Jesus. Now, he had been a part of the party hardy crowd with my parents, but he had decided that he needed to turn his life around. His life had been a little too party hardy, and he was going to a fundamentalist Bible church. And I confided in him one day after work, and I just said, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I can never come out to my parents. I have to suppress this." And he said, "No, you don't have to suppress it. Just go to the Harmony Bible Church, which is about 5 miles outside of our town." They were on the outskirts. "Give your life to Jesus, pray, and you can be healed." He said I could be relieved of my homosexual desires and find happy heterosexuality. What I found at that church was a lot of attention from an assistant pastor that I found very attractive. And after countless Bible studies, getting involved with the Jesus Freak movement, if anybody else remembers the 60s and the Jesus Freaks, well, I was kind of into everything. I look back on it now and I think I really was a chameleon too, because I wanted to be with the party hardy kids and go out and drink beer and smoke dope and whatever else and be crazy and wild and whatever. But then on Sunday morning, I'd go to church and give my life to Jesus, and I was even more of a chameleon than my parents. So after getting involved with that, and I went on a weekend trip to visit a Bible college where I could become a minister, I realized I had a deepening trust with this pastor, and I confided my worst fears in him. I'd been praying diligently to be relieved of my same-sex urges, but I hadn't yet found any growing desire for women. The male urges grew stronger, and I became totally disillusioned with the whole religion thing. Age 17 was a watershed year for me. A book that I'd found about sexuality, which is kind of interesting, it was in my parents' closet, you know, one of those stuck way high on the shelf. And my parents were married in 1946. That was the copyright of the book. And I realized that was probably their sex manual. But it was written in kind of old English with all the English spellings of the words, and it didn't talk about the real names, you know, the names that I grew up with learning for penis and vagina and whatever else. And so I also became the sex educator for all the local kids because we had this book, and I was going out there and teaching people that it's pronounced vagina, and I didn't know any better, but I learned a lot. And there was a chapter on homosexuality. And in that chapter on homosexuality, I think it was Havelock Ellis and some of those early sex researchers, and they weren't totally death on homosexuality, but they talked about it in a very matter-of-fact way. And one of the things that was in there that I just staked all my hopes on was that if a person hadn't been relieved of their, that in adolescence, people often go through a homosexual either stage, or the hormones are raging so much you don't know who you're attracted to. And so you can be attracted to most anything with two legs. Now, that's not true for everybody, and that wasn't certainly true for me. But I just kept hoping and praying that as I got older and got more through puberty, that I was going to find that healthy heterosexuality. But the desires only grew stronger as I grew through puberty. So Pastor Bill, the assistant pastor at this Bible church, told me I just wasn't praying hard enough. So I decided that I'd best snuff out the sexual desires and myself so my family would never know my secret. Somehow, despite my childhood doubts about God, I still felt there was some sort of a higher power. I just didn't understand what the Methodist Church or any other churches, those Bible stories or whatever. There was a higher power, but some of this church stuff didn't make any sense. And somehow with that innate sense, I did feel that my higher power felt that it was okay to be homosexual, but that was transcribed over with these societal messages. I was just really confused. So trusting my gut, I endeavored to let God decide my fate. I'd heard of Russian roulette. My brother, Steve, 4 years older than me, had already gone to college, so I was probably about 17, junior and senior year in high school. And he'd come home, and I grew up on a farm. We had this kind of a Cape Cod-style house with that big, long, attic-style bedroom. There was a stairwell in the middle with a banister that had posts, and Steve's pistol was hanging on that banister. And I decided he'd been keeping it loaded because there were ground squirrels in our yard. You know, it's a farm. He'd raise the window and take pot shots at the ground squirrels. I stood over the banister and I just said, God, if it's okay to be gay, this won't be loaded. If it's not, then I positioned myself so I'd fall over the banister so that if the gunshot didn't do it, the fall would. And obviously, the answer is here in front of you today. Thank God, whatever God is. Thank the universe. I had expected it to be loaded, but I just thought my parents wouldn't have to know that their son was a faggot. In my 17-year-old mind, my higher power had let me know that being gay was okay by giving me that empty chamber. And how could I really be sure I was gay yet? I really hadn't had any adult sexual experience with a man or a woman, so how could I know for sure? So the next 2 years or so of graduating from high school, summer construction jobs, heading to college, found me isolated from church and spirituality. I put that painful past behind me, but I still continued an inner belief in a higher being of some sort. The coping mechanism for college life and the coming out process was my growing alcohol dependence. I drank and I partied heavily. My sophomore year at college, 1975, found me drifting into a codependent relationship with a professor 11 years older. By this time, I had tried sex with women, usually drunken, but I found a much stronger attraction physically and emotionally to men. And despite the relationship with the professor, I still did a lot of playing around. It was the 70s, gay liberation, it was pre-AIDS, and I had low self-esteem. Not a good combination. Those years were very party-hardy. I joked with others that I went to the church of the open bottle. I had learned that phrase from a bartender that taught me how to tend bar. The other thing that didn't help was I grew up in Iowa, and when I was still in high school, they lowered the drinking age to 18. So it was even easier to go out and get wasted and be, quote, legal. And I took full advantage of that. My unwavering belief in anything spiritual was dying with a descent into alcoholism. But it was a series of chance occurrences that brought me to the doorstep of AA in 1980. My actual sobriety date was July 12, 1981. I learned in AA that I could put aside the God and religion that I was taught and develop a belief in a higher power that I was comfortable with. What freedom! My higher power became the force of energy that is behind all living and inert things. I guess the laws of physics. I grew my spiritual program in AA, but I found certain limitations and needed something more after a decade or 12 or so years of going to a lot of AA meetings. I quipped to some friends that if I go to another AA meeting and hear another drunkalogue, I'm going to go get stinking-faced drunk. Now, I am not denigrating AA at all because they are responsible for my even being here today. It's just that for myself, I was looking for something more beyond what I had learned in that program. And I still maintain contact with my AA friends, and I still periodically sponsor people. So please don't take that as any kind of denigration. They were, and I hear now that there's more emphasis on the God thing. When I was there, it was more just, don't let the God thing bother you. If you don't believe in God, that's fine. Believe in the group as your higher power, the table, the doorknob. It doesn't matter. Just, don't let the God thing trip you up. And in our church, they've started an agnostic 12-step group, which I think is good because evidently, I don't know if there's been more of a move to the right within AA circles or what the deal is, but evidently that's not as quite as true as it was when I went there. So, where am I? The 1980s raised more spiritual questions by witnessing the severe suffering and eventual death of close friends due to AIDS or to alcoholism. Now remember, 1981 is when we first began seeing cases of AIDS. People had become infected much earlier before that, but I was playing with fire based on my lifestyle. And I look back on the fact that I made it to AA in 1981 as being my salvation, because if I had not made it, I would not be standing here today. I would not have lived much beyond the 80s. I would be dead now because my behaviors were putting me at a lot of risk. In January and July of 1991, I lost two of my closest friends, ironically both named Stephen, to AIDS. In September of that same year, 91, the suicide of my brother Stephen led to another series of questions and the meaning of life. Remember, I tried it with my brother's pistol. My brother did it with my father's shotgun. So visions of my earlier attempts with Steve's pistol haunted me. How could he have actually done it, gone through with it? And how could I have attempted it? It just seemed so unreal. And even though I was angry with him, I thought, how can I be angry with him? Because I almost did the same thing. These emotional trials led me to discussions about things spiritual and theological. Several persons, especially a UU office mate, Kate Line, she told me that I was very UU, she herself was UU, and she encouraged me to try the Urbana Church. Another friend from healthcare, where I've worked for many years, had kept encouraging me to come to the UU church for our choir. Being a university town, we've always had a fabulous choir. We've had somebody from the university choral department as our conductor, and we've always had a great music program. And so I decided I'll give it a try. My belief in a higher power is energy, and belief in some sort of spirit world or universal consciousness persists. And my beliefs take twists and turns as I read, meditate, and discuss with others. The same kind of transformation occurs not just with me as an individual, but I notice it within our congregation in Urbana. And I'm sure that it's true here, that we grow as individuals, but we also grow together as a group. Sometimes we grow apart a little bit, and we have some rancor and yipping and yapping back and forth, but that's all a part of the process. We're always changing. And why do I share this story? My feelings of alienation from society as a child that almost took my life as an adolescent and a young adult were a direct result of the categorical thinking that is institutionalized in our society around us. That misery led me to near suicide and to actual alcoholism. I am forever grateful that in the UU Church, I found acceptance and affirmation with a diverse group of like-minded people. Now, it's my sense that most of our congregations welcome members of all abilities, races, sexual orientations, and identities. We are great at that. But according to Reverend Keith Cron, who is working with the UUA, Office of Ministerial Settlement, that's not always the case for the people that we call as our ministers. We sometimes have different levels of qualifications or attributes that we want to see in a minister. We need to make sure that our congregations extend that same warm welcome to persons that we consider for those ministerial and other leadership roles. And that's really what Beyond Categorical Thinking is all about. To not only see them as a person with a single dimension, but to learn about all those dimensions and to celebrate them as a whole person. And to also be a church that supports them rather than just seeing them as somebody that's there to support us. And that's another thread that weaves through the categorical thinking process. So thank you for having me here this morning. And those are my remarks.
Thank you, Jerry.